Good evening. I'm Dr. Sanford Katz, and welcome to Health Matters on Red River Radio. Tonight's Health Matters topic is an adult subject. The content may not be suitable for children or some listeners. Parental guidance is advised. Sexual dysfunction affects many adults, both men and women. Often such difficulties are related to a health condition or can be the effect of medical treatment. Tonight, I am joined in the studio by marriage and family therapist, Dr. Kelly Tyner, physical therapist, Jenny Lewis, urologist, Dr. Gerard Henry, and gynecologist, Dr. Deborah Klein. We will be discussing some of the causes and possible treatments of sexual dysfunction. Good evening and welcome.
Hello.
Thank you. Doctors and Jenny, thank you very much for being here this evening. I'd like to start off a little bit. We have a lot to talk about this evening, and I'd like to talk first about what exactly is sexual dysfunction. And we are very fortunate this evening to have representatives from the medical community and the mental health community and the physical therapy community. And we're going to talk a little bit about both male and female sexual dysfunction. So, Dr. Henry, as a urologist who specializes in male sexual dysfunction, let's start with you. How would you define sexual dysfunction in men?
In men, usually it's the inability to have an erection firm enough for sex. It's different than in women, but also in addition, you can have low testosterone and issues like that. But usually the baseline issue in men is the inability to have an erection firm enough for sex.
Okay, thank you. And Dr. Klein, how is sexual dysfunction defined in women?
In women, it involves a lack of desire for sex and the inability to be aroused during sex or to achieve orgasm during sex. It can be all of those or any one of those things. And I define it as when those problems exist at a level that creates a psychosocial stress in the patient. If they are concerned with it, if it bothers them, if it bothers their relationship with their partner, then the problem exists, and that can be at varying levels and with varying patients. The main thing is if they express a concern about their ability to perform or their desire for sex, then the problem exists.
So it sounds like from what the two of you have described, is that there's mechanical aspects, it sounds like there's emotional aspects, psychological aspects, and relationship aspects. Dr. Tyner, how would you define sexual dysfunction within the context of a relationship?
I would think it would include both of the things that have already been mentioned here, but that there's not a mutually pleasing relationship between the couple, that either one or both of them identify a lack of satisfaction with the sexual aspect of their relationship.
Okay, so now you're a marriage and family therapist. How is a marriage and family therapist different than other type of counselors?
We're relatively similar. Marriage and family therapists are trained to look at relationships specifically. I even will tell my marital couples that the client is your relationship itself. So. Not necessarily just the husband or just the wife, but so trying to look at how that relationship functions, whether it's a family or a marital couple, and assist that system to work in more harmony than it has been working.
Okay, very good. Dr. Henry, what are some of the physiologic changes that occur as men age, which can impact their sexual function?
Obviously, as you get older, typically your physical attributes like blood pressure, cholesterol can worsen. Also, your physical ability can worsen. Anything that decreases blood flow, as we stated earlier, in a man, it's typically a physical phenomenon of being able to achieve an erection. The other thing is we could call low testosterone andropause in men, so that can account for a lot of it too. So weaker, tired, or lower sex drive are those things that go along with low testosterone andropause in men.
Okay. Wanted to invite listeners to call in their questions tonight at 1-800-552-8502. Our panel are available to answer your questions and take your comments. So, Dr. Henry, there's a lot of advertisements for medications and treatments for male erectile dysfunction. You mentioned some of the causes. What are the more common causes for erectile dysfunction related to health conditions specifically? You mentioned quite a number. And to what degree do you find that it's related to medical treatments, medications, things of that sort?
Great question, Dr. Katz. Obviously, anything that affects your heart, first of all, pretty much affects your erections. So that's an easy thing for the audience to understand is, you know, things that affect your heart like blood pressure, cholesterol, inactivity, obesity, smoking are also going to affect the blood flow for erections in addition. As far as the marketing goes, I would not advise anybody to use anything like over-the-counter remedies like you'll see at gas stations right there by the cashier. I would not buy any of those. I don't think they work. They haven't been shown in any studies that actually work.
So what does work? There are three main pills you see advertised. Is one better than another? Is there advantages to one? And now it sounds like they want you men to take one of these pills every day. What should our listeners be thinking about all these ads that they're encountering?
Well, the ads are, of course, typically for Viagra, Levitra, and Cialis. Cialis has come up with a daily pill that's 5 milligrams daily. It's because it has a long half-life. Typically, I tell patients to try all of them. I give samples and script, and they try them, and whatever one they like the best, I'm happy to give them.
Okay. So, Dr. Klein, we've heard quite a bit about male erectile dysfunction as a major cause of sexual dysfunction in men. Now, you mentioned quite a number of things in your initial description of sexual dysfunction in women. What are some of the causes for sexual dysfunction in women, and to what degree do medical conditions, medications, surgeries, and other interventions that people may undergo, to what degree does that affect women's ability to have satisfying sexual relations?
Well, I define female sexual dysfunction as really being divided into two parts. The psychosocial and the hormonal. The psychosocial aspects to female dysfunction are primarily seen in younger women before menopause, and then the hormonal ones are primarily seen after menopause. And it is two entirely different pictures of female sexual dysfunction. In the psychosocial realm, in younger women, a lot of times there are simple things like depression, anxiety, a history of abuse that may enter into the woman's inability to desire and to respond to sexual activity. Very rarely in a premenopausal woman is it anything hormonal. The hormonal aspects really come into play after menopause. Those problems are ironically easier to deal with. As far as surgery goes, obviously hysterectomy plays into this a great deal. A so-called simple hysterectomy, or where only the uterus is removed, doesn't typically bother a female sexual function. When the ovaries are removed and there's a so-called surgical menopause, the ovaries are the source of hormonal production in women. Then there can be basically the problems that occur in a normally physiological menopausal woman. Sometimes there are surgeries that are done for pelvic support when women have urinary incontinence that can play into improvement or into impairment of sexual performance. One of the things that can also happen is any suturing or laceration that's done as a result of childbirth and the trauma that can occur in that area can create pain and discomfort with sex that can interfere with female sexual desire too. So certainly normal things that occur in a woman's life, pregnancy and childbirth and menopause, and course, hysterectomy being the most common surgery performed in the United States nowadays can all play into the female sexual dysfunction.
So there are pills and other interventions available for men to address the mechanical difficulties they may have in terms of their sexual dysfunction. What's available for women aside from hormonal replacement that can assist them when they're having mechanical difficulties, painful intercourse, and other pelvic floor issues?
Well, prescription-wise, not much. And there are really no medications that are FDA approved specifically for female sexual dysfunction. Now, many of them address the issues of vaginal dryness and some of the changes that occur to the lining of the vagina after menopause, topical estrogens, even an oral medication now called Osfina can help with that. But there are no hormonal contributors or prescriptions that can be given for that. Testosterone is also a source for female arousal and desire. We don't make as much as men, but what we do make plays into that. And testosterone supplementation in women is very precarious. There are a lot of side effects to it, and there have been medications that have been given to the FDA for approval to address this that have been rejected because of their effects on women's cholesterol and for side effects like weight gain and hair growth that are unpleasant. So although testosterone is probably the one hormone that can help a woman's sexual desire, you have to be very careful about how you prescribe it and because of the side effects. And there is also not a specific branded FDA-approved form of testosterone to give women.
I see. So, Jenny, let's bring you into the discussion. I understand you work quite a bit with women and with pelvic floor dysfunction. Let's define pelvic floor dysfunction first off, and talk a little bit about what it is that you do to assist women with sexual dysfunction and pelvic floor issues.
Typically, in my practice for pelvic floor dysfunction, I see women who are having pain with intercourse, and it's usually attributed to some type of muscle spasm internally. And so, through my treatment, it's we work on muscular release or myofascial release and try to let that muscle let go. For some reason, it's hanging on and it causes them pain with penetration. There can be other reasons, factors playing into that, being hormonal changes at times, sexual assault or a history. And that's where, you know, to work as a team, it really helps in my part of the practice where referring the patient to counseling or the GYN can help with other aspects of that all for us.
I see. So some of it is involuntary muscle spasm that you can work with. Explain a little bit about biofeedback.
Well, biofeedback is when we can either insert a small device vaginally or use stickers on the outside, and it reads the electrical activity of the muscle, of kind of what's going on. What is it doing at rest? What does it do when they try to contract and when they try to relax? So if they're having some overactivity, that muscle kind of just hanging on, you're not seeing it drop down into normal resting tone. And through some exercise and kind of just getting those muscles recoordinated, sometimes they'll learn to relax again. And if, you know, during... If as a female, if you know that your husband wants to have intercourse and you're anticipating pain, you're going to tense up even more. So it's going to make it hurt more, and that kind of feeds into the whole cycle for these women. So it's kind of a slow way to help break the cycle for them, too, and start enjoying it again.
So you're able to work with them and help work them through some of these involuntary muscular contractions. And I see. That sounds like it must be very rewarding work. Tonight's Health Matters topic is an adult subject. The content may not be suitable for children or some listeners. Parental guidance is advised. Dr. Tyner, it sounds during our conversations that there's, in addition to mechanical difficulties for both the men and women, that there is often an overriding psychological component. What is your experience in working with individuals and couples as to the degree to which psychological issues are a contributing cause or a major cause to sexual dysfunction in either or both? And to what degree do you find that sexual dysfunction itself causes psychological difficulties within the relationship?
Okay, that's a lot. Let's see. I would say as far as the impact that it could have on the relationship, that's what you're asking me. Correct?
That was part B.
Part B. Let's go with part B first then. The sexual dysfunction being present, how can it affect the relationship? There's so many different ways. The couple themselves can have a lot of individual, you know, struggles with that. If the female is the one with the sexual dysfunction, there may be feelings of not wanting to disappoint her spouse, feeling inadequate in some way. Cheating usually gets brought up if one or the other is in my office. If some kind of sexual dysfunction is going on, there's often the question brought up: do you not find me attractive? Do you find someone else attractive? So that's always something that at least has to be gone through. Could you repeat part A so that I get back on track?
Well, part A being the degree to which psychological issues themselves are contributing to the sexual dysfunction. I understand you do a fair amount of work with veterans and post-traumatic stress disorder. And so, mm-hmm. you know, I'm curious to what degree people may have some baseline psychological issues. Dr. Klein mentioned trauma. Mm-hmm. To what degree are those the contributing cause or a contributing cause as opposed to a, you know, some other cause, whether a direct physical cause?
Okay. Usually when I get them, there's not a direct physical cause. It is a psychological cause. They've gone through all the avenues to try and have it addressed other ways. Of course, some have already been mentioned with any kind of sexual assault. I've had women who have come to see me as a result of sexual dysfunction or pain associated with childbirth, with scarring and whatnot, and just the emotional impact of that. Working with veterans, there's quite a bit, especially those who not only suffer with PTSD but also with traumatic brain injury. There's quite a bit of stuff going on with those guys. Some of it related to the medications that they take for whatever problems that they have, high blood pressure. There's a particular medication out there that's given for nightmares. That's actually a blood pressure medication, and it can impact sexual desire quite a bit. So any kind of trauma. Obviously. And then relational issues, more so for women, I find they have, when the satisfaction in the marriage isn't very high, sexual desire isn't very high either. Not so much for men. It doesn't seem to impact them as much, but definitely for women. Any type of conflict in the marriage, any kind of misunderstandings, something that seems so very small can build and eventually exacerbate the relationship, the problems that were already there, and then all of a sudden there's no desire to have sex on either or both.
I see. Dr. Henry, to what degree do you see relationship issues being a major factor in the sexual dysfunction that men come to see you for? And how do you discern when you see a man in the office the degree to which it's a relationship versus physiological? And I'm also curious as to whether men typically come in by themselves or if they come in with their partner.
Men typically come in by themselves, I would say 75%. Usually when they come in with their partner, there may be an aspect to the relationship, but usually when guys come in by themselves, there's usually not too many issues with psychological. It's pretty much a physical phenomenon, and doc, it doesn't work anymore. Can you help me?
The men don't sound nearly as complex as the women do.
No, it's much more easy. I was just thinking that listening to Dr. Tyner and Dr. Klein talk, it's... I think I definitely have the easier job.
I see. So this easier job of yours, when someone comes in and let's say you've evaluated them and they have tried some of these pills unsuccessfully, what's the next step?
Well, Dr. Katz, you're speaking my language right now. I am there for when the pills don't work. Second line therapy is typically the vacuum erection device, self-injection, where they give themselves a shot in the penis 10 to 15 minutes before, and there's a little pellet they put down their urethra that can work, and it's usually not very good. We also do some workup like testosterone and urinalysis and some other things, but yeah, that's the typical patient I see is when Viagra, Levitra, or Cialis no longer work.
Okay, so they've tried the injections, they've tried the pellet, the testosterone levels are fine, or they've been adjusted. Still not much success. Let's say they've had prostate cancer and they've been treated for prostate cancer. What's the next step for these gentlemen?
Well, typically when they failed all medical therapies, we move on to surgery, and that is the inflatable penile prosthesis for those with good hand function. Those without good hand function, we put in semi-rigid rods. That's only about 2%. It works very successful in my hands, about 150 last year, and there's probably about 1,800 guys in the Shreveport area that have one over the last 10 years.
No kidding. Wow, and that is that, as you said, sounds like it's a treatment of last resort, but is often very effective. Now, does these implants, do those result in men being able to have an ejaculation or just to achieve penetration?
The inflatable penile prosthesis is to make it straight and firm on demand. It does not help with sensation or orgasm. Those are much more difficult issues typically.
Okay. And how often do you see men come in the office with specifically orgasm-related or ejaculation-related issues?
I would say only about 10% of guys come in specifically as their leading issue, delayed orgasms or anorgasm. Almost as many come in with the opposite, premature ejaculation. And we can try different medicines, adjusting medicines and things like that to try to treat them.
How do you define prolonged, delayed, and premature?
Premature ejaculation, depending upon what society you look at, the society I'm associated with is less than 30 seconds of penetration. And it also can be adjusted to just patient perceiving or patient perception. And delayed orgasm is, once again, more of a patient perception issue. But there are quite a few guys who come in who can't have orgasms at all. And amazing, most of them are just on antidepressants, and you take them off that, and usually it helps.
So another example of where medical treatments can affect sexual function. Dr. Klein, you mentioned earlier a couple times about sexual dysfunction for women, including inability to have an orgasm. How would you address that if a woman came in having orgasm dysfunction?
Well, the first question I ask is, have they ever had an orgasm? And if they have, how and where? If they're able to achieve orgasm through masturbation, then they can achieve orgasm with sexual activity with a partner. It is very rare to come across a patient that is physiologically incapable of achieving an orgasm. After that, I usually question her about things like what Dr. Henry deals with, primarily premature ejaculation and her husband's ability to, or her partner, I should say, ability to achieve an erection. I usually go into a discussion about her psychosocial status. Once again, depression and anxiety and some of the things we come across, and stress in particular. You're talking about women and sexual dysfunction being a more complex issue. Mm-hmm. One of the things I tell patients all the time is that for women, sex is 90% mental and 10% physical, and for men, it's the exact opposite ratio. I don't know if those are statistically accurate, but I think it makes my point that being mentally engaged in sexual activity is a key for a woman with any type of sexual dysfunction. And if there is a distraction, if there's worry, if there's a past history, if there's conflict with the person that they are trying to achieve an orgasm with, there's going to be a problem, or there can be a problem. So I usually talk about that. Some patients are fine. They've been able to have orgasms. They're getting along well with their partner, and you know, maybe they are tired, or what I call the two F's, fatigue and familiarity, which I'm tired, it's been a long day, or we've been together forever, been there, done that, and so it doesn't become a priority for them anymore. And that's something I have to kind of talk and be their cheerleader about. But if that fails, if talking through those issues fails, sometimes I will add a form of testosterone, usually provided by a compounding pharmacy. Just a 1% testosterone ointment can sometimes get a woman interested again, get her over that barrier, that psychological barrier, and to where she can respond to what she has responded to before. When I have patients who have serious psychological barriers to orgasm or who have never achieved it, sometimes I look into the pain aspect, and then I may have to use physical therapy like what Jenny provides in the Willis-Knighton system. And sometimes I engage a psychologist as well, too, to talk about the issues they have with their spouse or may have had with a previous partner who was abusive.
I see. So, Dr. Tyner, we're getting back into the psychological aspects of this. And Dr. Klein mentioned familiarity, or for lack of a better term, let's say boredom. So when you encounter an individual or a couple, how would you approach that complaint that the familiarity, the boredom is contributing to sexual dysfunction and perhaps intimacy issues? What would be your approach?
This happens a lot, actually, and we get into relationships, and it's really great, and there's a lot of sparks flying in the very beginning, and you're very engaged with that person, and you put a lot of effort and time and energy into the relationship, and then as the relationship grows, as you've been together, then maybe some of those things that you didn't do in the beginning, or that you did do in the beginning, you don't do now. The wooing, and men like to hunt. We talk about that a lot in therapy. Men like to hunt, and when they've caught the prey, then they're done. They've caught it. It's sitting on the couch over there watching TV with them, and so there's not a lot of effort put into the relationship. So when couples with that problem come in, it's just about teaching them to get back to what got them interested in the first place, the things that they were doing in the beginning and the connection that they were making, and trying to find those mutually pleasing activities so that they can, really develop intimacy as opposed to just sex itself, but focusing on the relationship and the connection.
I want to follow up with that, but before I do, I want to once again to give the phone number. That's 1-800-552-8502. And I want to encourage listeners to call in. And if you'd prefer to send in via email a question and not come on the air, that's certainly possible too. And our panelists are here, be happy to address your questions. So, Dr. Tyner, you mentioned some of these changes that occur in the course of a long relationship. What if you find that a couple are just divergent in terms of their sexual desire, the degree to which it's important to one versus the other, and they just really can't come together in terms of you know, what one person wants and what the other person is happy with? How do you address that?
I would try to take some of the focus off of the actual act itself, again, and getting back to you know, just the relationship. Rarely does a couple come in where they're just pleased as punch with the relationship. They're just only have problems with the sexual aspect of that relationship. There's always some issues going on. So maybe putting sex on the back burner for a moment, and let's look at these other things that are going on. She's saying that she's had a long day, she's tired, and she's, you know, had to wash clothes, and she's had to do dinner, and he's hanging out on the couch watching TV and not really engaged. And so trying to pick those things out. Doesn't take too much effort, though, because a lot of times they're throwing things at me. He does this, she does this. And so there's usually a lot of things that can be worked on where you don't even have to address. That's a minimal thing. Usually by the time they come into therapy, it's in there. It's in the box. We're not having sex, but we're also not doing these other things either.
So could watching or reading 50 Shades of Grey help with some of these issues?
I guess it could. I guess, it's maybe something new and interesting can be brought into the relationship, and not just that, but anything new could temporarily re-engage a couple. But I do find that when the excitement of that goes away, that you're still left with the problems that were there before. So sure, temporarily, 50 Shades of Grey would work.
So. Conversely, though, would you be concerned that much in the way that male-directed porn has been criticized for fostering unrealistic expectations and comparisons with one's partner, are you concerned that 50 Shades of Grey might do the same thing and contribute to greater dissatisfaction amongst women?
I think it already has. 50 Shades of Grey it's a not that novel of an idea. It's a great kind of avenue to go down, something that hasn't been in mainstream media. But women have been reading romance novels for a long time and have these unrealistic expectations about what relationships are and what men are going to do and say and how they're going to act based on romance novels. And I jokingly call romance novels women's porn. It's very similar, just more feeling.
So we touched a little bit on childbirth and some of the physiologic and physical changes that can occur after childbirth and the impact it could have on sexual relations. Jenny, what do you encounter in your practice as far as difficulties that women encounter after having a child, and what is your approach? How do you work with them, and what do you find is successful?
Well, when, you know, they come in and they may tell me, since the physician has released them back to having, you know, intercourse with their partner, and they attempt to have intercourse and it's just, you know, they have pain now and they never had that before. So then we go into, you know, what was your delivery like? Did you have some tearing? Is there scar tissue? And then from there we can kind of see what is the target of, you know, what we need to fix. And then through examination, you know, if it's some scarring, we'll work on some scar tissue release and teach them how to do that also at home. And if it's just the muscle spasming up, and, you know, they're usually excited to get back at that point. You know, they're tired with the baby, but they're excited to get that back part of their relationship back. I'm not necessarily seeing the psychological aspects at that point when they're, you know, fresh from having a baby.
Okay. Now, as a radiation oncologist and Dr. Klein working in the cancer center as well with women with gynecologic cancers, we often see women who have sexual difficulty relating to the surgeries and oftentimes radiation to their pelvis. And I know that you work with these women as well. How does that problem, how is that addressed differently than, let's say, someone in the postpartum period, and what do you find in that population in terms of success?
Well, with that population, I typically see them post radiation when they're kind of completed with all their radiation treatments, and at that point they're mentally not ready for sex. They just say, "I've given my husband 6 kids and cancer, I'm done." And I say, okay, we're not there, but we need to get your body ready to be there. And so through that, I teach them how to use dilators to slowly stretch out those tissues because they can kind of shrink up or contract via the scar tissue and post effects from radiation.
Could you explain what a dilator is?
They're small instruments. They range in sizes. It's usually the set comes in a five-size pack. The first one would probably be the size of your index finger, and the last one would be the size of a penis. So they need to gradually kind of stretch that vaginal vault back out, and, you know, for to be able to have intercourse and to be able to go back and follow up with their GYN and be examined because they're going to be watched closely because of their medical history. They can be difficult. Some of these women are just, you know, so thankful and they see a new lease on life and they're ready to get back to their old life. Others are just exhausted and tired and they want to go home. So, you know, is their motivation varies, and a lot of it depends on their social support at home, on what they're really wanting to get back to. And I tell them, you know, if intercourse is not your goal, that's okay, but the physician is going to still be able to need to get in there and check and make sure there's no recurrences and stuff. So you still need to do this medically.
So even if you're not engaging in intercourse, it's still important that you're able to be examined, and that alone may be sufficient reason to keep those tissues pliable and open.
Correct.
Yeah. So, Dr. Klein, let's say a woman comes in and is having difficulties of various sorts. Is there what can they expect in terms of evaluation, tests, types of examinations or procedures that they may need? What walk us down a typical course for a woman coming in to see you, saying I'm having difficulty. What would be the first few things you would do?
Well, the first thing, as in any doctor-patient visit, is to get a history of the problem. And, you know, how often does she think of sex? You know, does she think about it at all? Because part of it is not only wanting it when it's offered, but thinking about it when you're not around it. I would also say... medical issues play into it. You know, what medications is she on? What medical conditions might she have that decrease libido? Thyroid problems can do it. Certainly depression, anxiety, and the medications that are given for that can do it. What kind of physical condition is she in? You know, so in general, a good medical history and physical exam can give you an insight into why this is happening. But most of the time, I just have a talk with them about, you know, this is normal. This is common. You know, 40% of women at some point in their life have an issue with this. And so they need to be reassured that something is not wrong with just them. And a lot of times they use an F word that I hate, frigid. And there's really no medical term for that. I have to remind them that they have this ability. They have the ability to enjoy sex. They just, for something is getting in the way of that. And most of the time in women, unlike men, it is not a specific lab value. It's not a specific physical finding. It may be all of that together. You can address this problem without even doing a pelvic exam. If someone is having pain, I think, then you have to. But if it's simply just a desire thing, a lot of it is reassurance. I also tell patients that, you know, in no means am I old-fashioned enough to think that we, you know, it's our duty to give in and to give sex, but that it needs to be a mutual event. And if they want to be engaged in their relationships, then they need to consider it a priority. And I also have, you know, it seems like two different categories of patients. One who wants to want it. you know, used to have it, enjoy it, and doesn't anymore. And then I have some patients who, you know, it's never been a priority for them. It's never been something that they've wanted. And I'm having much easier in with the patients that want it. And a lot of times just reassurance and feedback that they'll get it back again. They just have to give into their interest rather than into the things that distract them from that interest. And there are a lot of distractions in the world today. And so I'll talk about how busy and how harried they are. And sometimes they have to look at what they're doing in their life and say, okay, tonight I'm going to make a date with my husband or my partner, my boyfriend, whatever. And make that as much of their schedule as going to the grocery store or going to work or getting their hair done. You know, and when they re-engage in that and put it as a priority, a lot of times then the rest of it comes with it. If it's a pain issue, then you have to get into the gynecologic reasons why that may be part of their problem. And that can be something that does require a lot of testing, that does require ultrasounds and hormone levels and things like that. But that is even when that is performed, you don't always find a reason for it. There's a lot of times the pain is because of the hesitation during sex because of the fact that mentally and psychologically she's not engaged in the activity.
Not there. Thank you. Once again, tonight's health topic is an adult subject. We are discussing sexual dysfunction, and the content may not be suitable for children and some listeners, and parental guidance is advised. Once again, we are available and taking your calls at 1-800-552-8502. You can call in a question, a comment, or you can send an email and your question sent online via redriverradio.org. So, Dr. Henry, how common is sexual dysfunction, specifically erectile dysfunction, in men? And at what age groups do you see it in terms of frequency?
Thank you, Dr. Katz. Erectile dysfunction, just like most medical conditions in men, increase with age. Interesting, the highest decade for use of Viagra and Cialis is the 40s. That is the decade of life where the most pills are bought.
And why do you think that is?
Lots of men in their 40s start to have they lose the ability to maintain an erection. They have almost a midlife crisis type thing, and they wish to have it back where they were when they're in their 20s. They know there's now medicine that helps, and it does help. And they go out and get it.
So what happens when they're in their 50s and 60s? Do they just have a more realistic view? Do they give up? Or they what's going on?
I would say a variety of that. Maybe a little more giving up. Of course, I wish they didn't. I wish they came on in and got treated. And also, maybe it's not as high a priority. Mm-hmm. But don't kid yourself. I see guys in their 80s that are widowers getting remarried, and I see a load of guys in their 30s that are been type 1 diabetics for 30 years. So it is a huge age range. And I even see guys in their 20s who've been in a car accident or motorcycle wreck.
I see. And what about recreational use of these drugs?
For sure. I mean, What does Cialis Viagra do? Well, it helps you have what's called a shorter refractory period, meaning a male can have an orgasm faster a second time on the medicine. They can get an erection. The latency period is shorter on the medicine. So, of course, there's recreational usage, in, i.e., the guys in their 40s using it.
I see. We have a caller that called in a question, and this was for Dr. Tyner. The question is, what does one do if they want to have a sexual relationship with their partner, however their partner is at a point where they're just fine living without one, and there's a general disconnect. The partner without the interest doesn't want to pursue any sort of treatment or evaluation. What would you recommend, or how would you approach this if someone came to you in this sort of scenario?
It actually happens quite a bit that there's a not necessarily just with sexual problems, but where one member of the couple is motivated to change something within the relationship, and the other person is not. You know, actually refuses to attend any kind of sessions or get any kind of treatment. And all you can do in those situations is look at the things with that individual that they are interested or that they're capable of changing. So the other person is not interested in having sex. The person who is interested can look at ways that they maybe could engage the individual. Like say it's the female not wanting to go to therapy or go to the doctor, and the male is interested. Well, I would help him to look at ways that he might try to reconnect with his wife on a more intimate level. What types of things can you do? So just focusing on the things that you have control over as opposed to what you don't have control over.
And in your experience, to what extent does this sort of scenario ultimately lead to extramarital activity?
That's fairly frequent, actually. I see that a lot, especially in couples who have been together for some time, and like Dr. Klein was talking about, just it's very, very familiar. There's nothing, there's no spark. And people start to, both men and women start to question, is it me? Is there something going on with me that makes this not work? And so they reach out outside of the marriage to, as a tester initially, I think a lot of times to see if in fact there's anything going on with them. You know, if it's not working with this person, does it also not work with this person? Or is it, we sure like to get the blame off of ourselves a lot of times. So if you can place the blame somewhere else, so it's not me, I'm working just fine and everything's going well. See, I can do it with this person. Then the blame's off of you.
So is that knowledge, that information helpful at solving the problem?
The problem of sexual dysfunction or the
within the relationship?
I think any time that an affair is introduced into the marriage or into the relationship, it's harmful. Can it come? Can it turn out in a positive way? Yeah, it can. I see that as being more of a harmful side effect of that.
So I've had personal experience with patients where, and I asked Dr. Henry about this, if they come in with their partner or without their partner, but treating patients with prostate cancer like I do and sexual dysfunction in this population, both prior and after treatment, can be quite typical. I've been pretty impressed by how often I will inquire about sexual function in the man, and it will be acknowledged that that there's difficulty in front of the partner, but that he is not particularly interested in addressing it. And then privately, he will confide that he is actually quite functional with another partner. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, in a situation like that, it seems very complicated and. That sounds like a situation which would be right up your alley. You know, we're talking a lot about partners and couples and spouses. I understand that you work with the gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender community as well.
I do.
So this is a problem that is not restricted just to the heterosexual community, it appears.
No, absolutely not. You will find the same type of problems in all different types of couples. It's not simply a male female connection thing. It's a people connection thing. Of course, that's just it doesn't include any of the physical aspects of sexual dysfunction at all, but just the relational aspects. Women do to women the same that women do to men, and men the same way. So you find very similar issues.
And even when it's not mechanical.
Yes.
Dr. Henry, do you have any experience with any special issues in the gay community with respect to sexual dysfunction that may be helpful to our listeners?
I usually don't go down the avenue of the psychological aspect. I've treated a whole multitude of homosexual men, no problem.
Okay, so this is not exclusive of the heterosexual community. It is interesting to me, though, that it has become so much of our culture that it's so open now that we can talk about it, and it's in the advertisements and television and the Super Bowl. And to what degree do you find, Dr. Henry, that men are interested in talking about this? Do they tend to come to you with these problems, or is this something that you find during screening for other issues that you might be treating?
For me, they're coming pretty much to see me for erectile dysfunction.
Specifically. And how are they getting to you as opposed to, let's say, their primary care physician or their, let's say, they see a urologist for another issue? What is the process by which they would come to see you specifically?
To be honest, I would say my number one referrer right now is prior patients. You know, they're with their buddies, playing cards, and they start joking around, talking, and they say, I'm better than I was when I was 18. And they say, what do you mean? And they go down discussing that aspect, and my name must be brought up somewhere along the line because they're showing up.
I see. And when they're coming to see you, they're coming after they've already received the medications and have been unsuccessful, typically?
Typically, yes.
Okay. So for a man who, let's say, has not gotten to that point and is starting to have difficulty, what would you recommend he do? Who should he see?
If can see their primary care doctor, of course, initially. I mean, I think the first line therapy for virtually all male problems is the PDE5 inhibitors. I'm not talking about if they have low testosterone, premature ejaculation, but for any issues with firmness, it should be PDE5 inhibitors first.
I see. Those are the pills. Now, we heard a little bit about menopause and its impact upon sexual dysfunction in men. What about this andropause? Can you speak a little bit about that?
Dr. Katz. I sure would like to. Andropause, which is hypogonadism, which is low testosterone in men, is typically when the testosterone level is less than 300. That's kind of the nationally accepted level. Different labs could say different things, but that's where we're at. And what does testosterone do? Well, it increases, obviously, sex drive. We've heard that. Also increases energy, mood, muscle, power, bone health, and decreases fat. If I told you there was a drug that would do all that for you, a lot of guys would come in and get treated.
And is this standard medical practice? Is this covered by insurance? Is this elective?
Low testosterone is a recognized medical condition and is pretty much treated by all insurances.
Okay, and how is low testosterone treated? What are the different ways of replacing testosterone?
Typically, first-line therapy is the gels, lotions, creams. There is also actually a buckle. That means inside the lip. The second biggest one would be shots, intramuscular shots, and we do a lot of pellets. These are long-acting. They last several months, pellets that you place under the skin. Typically, for those, I see those patients back about 5 to 6 months later.
Okay, and hormone replacement in women, Dr. Klein, I understand it was very commonplace and has become more controversial. What are you seeing and recommending in your practice?
Well, first of all, the most common hormone replacement that's given has very little effect on a postmenopausal woman's libido. Typically, what is given is estrogen, sometimes in combination with progesterone. Those hormones are given mainly for hot flashes. They do help with bone density as well. But estrogen and progesterone do not increase libido to any notable effect. They can increase or improve vaginal lubrication and integrity and minimize some of the discomfort that is associated with vaginal dryness after menopause. The controversy with these medications is that there is an increased risk of breast cancer and with blood clots, heart attack, and stroke in women who use them longer than 5 years and women who use them over 65. So you do have to have a limited window, so to speak, of when you can give it. A lot of women notice other good things about hormone replacement, just a greater sense of well-being. They sleep better, they feel better, and it can improve their outlook. But they have no direct effect on the biochemical reasons for libido in women. It is a testosterone-driven phenomenon in women, just like it is in men. And so the only way to use hormones to improve sexual function in women is to give some type of testosterone. But there, once again, is no FDA-approved formulation for that. And you generally have to have this specially made in a compounding pharmacy.
I see. And the compounding pharmacies, these are local and...
Yeah, usually not the chain pharmacies that most people use for their prescription medications. They're usually locally owned, run by a family, and the medications are actually mixed and formulated within a lab within that pharmacy. There are a lot of medications that are made up this way, but generally speaking, their formulas sometimes it can be tweaked, a little bit of estrogen, a little bit of testosterone, you know, depending on the patient and his needs. And a lot of times there are hormone levels drawn to determine this. I don't have a whole lot of faith in that. I think that basically with women, hormones are all or none. You either have them or you don't, and having a higher this or a lower that doesn't really impact much. So what I would tell women is if you are interested in hormones, you need to see a board-certified gynecologist to make sure you get what is the standard of care with hormone replacement.
Very good. Thank you very much. I want to thank all of my guests this evening for coming on and discussing this very important topic, particularly as Valentine's Day is quickly approaching. Once again, I want to thank Dr. Kelly Tyner, physical therapist Jenny Lewis, Dr. Gerard Henry, and Dr. Deborah Klein. Thank you very much. Health Matters is a program for informational purposes only. For all health questions, you should consult a physician or health professional. This show is available for download from redriverradio.org. Health Matters is a production of Red River Radio. The producer is Renee Moran, with production assistance provided by Wally Derleth and Henry Edwards. Production of Health Matters is made possible in part by the Knoll Foundation and the Community Foundation of North Louisiana, and also by the Gables at Spring Lake. Gamble Guest Care's assisted living community, located behind Spring Lake Guest Care Center on Line Avenue in Shreveport. Learn more at GableGuestCare.com. I'm Dr. Sanford Katz. Thank you for joining us this evening.